Just a couple of questions were put out in the box. By the way, I have checked my zipper. I'm okay. And somebody did come up to me and say, "Boy, I'm so glad we have that on tape. That was so funny." And I thought, it wasn't funny. It was humiliating. And I'm hoping the tape dies somewhere in the future. Couple of questions. What does the admonition about ignoring the breach in the wall have to do with curiosity? And I guess what I may not have expanded on that very well, but the idea that I think a good leader would be curious about what's behind the breach in the wall, as opposed to, you know, I use the example of the wall in my home that I was just painting over. And instead of having some curiosity about, I wonder why there's a circle up there, and I wonder why it's getting bigger, and I wonder what, and thinking about what's behind it, there was kind of a, and so I think a curiosity about what's beneath the behavior, a curiosity about what might be going on. And I think that that's, you know, that's where I made that association with that passage, the idea of breaching the wall, and the importance of a shepherd protecting. In the way that one of the ways you protect is you don't take lightly things that are important. You don't, and so that's kind of what I meant by that. How did you arrive at curiosity, humility, and love for stories? What makes those more essential than other attributes like courage and honesty? Gosh, great question. And obviously there's some things that I think everybody would agree that shepherding would always include. I think all counseling, all shepherding is at some level a truth-telling operation. And so I kind of consider honesty as kind of one of those values that you're not going to be helping someone if at some level, I mean, you have to learn to sometimes say hard things gently, but at some level, all shepherding and counseling is a truth-telling operation. And so I just would... I kind of had that as one of those assumptions that we would all have together more than something that, but you know, the real reason I picked curiosity, humility, and love for stories is after years of teaching the counseling students, it seemed like they came in often with good listening skills. They came in with some training in counseling or in the Bible. But what they often were missing were those things, the kind of an idea of be curious, ask more questions, ask open-ended questions. That seemed to be something that they had a hard time. You know, I don't know how many times I had someone come to me and say, I'd say, "Well, why are you wanting to be in the counseling program?" They say, "Well, I'm just really good with people, and people always come to me with their problems." And then when they'd get in the clinic, I would find that they were pretty quick to just tell other people what to do, and they didn't have that curiosity. And so so that was a category that I thought very gifted people at shepherding sometimes didn't have. Humility is always a part of whatever we should be doing for the kingdom of God, because it is ultimately his work, not ours, and we should be just humbled by the fact that he's invited us to be a part of it. And so that's why I would include that. And then I've been kind of enamored, as you'll find out later on tonight, about the way that the narrative nature of God, the way that he tells story. And it's how Jesus taught, and I think it's just a helpful thing to be, the categories of story give you very good categories for helping and listening to people. But I don't think those are, like, I can't point to a verse that says, you know, and then Paul said to make sure you're curious, whatever the other two are. I don't have a proof text for it. I just think it's, and so I don't think it's the only three things you need to be a counselor. It's just the things that seemed missing in the lives of my students over the years, who I think were pretty talented at this, that they naturally came in with a lot of skills, yet the things that seemed to be missing in them that would have taken and helped them be a better shepherd were those things. But that was just more observation. And so I could be wrong, but it was just, those were just some helpful things for me. This is just a profound question I'm about to read. And it is a question every one of you could write 5 years from now. And when I say that, you go, then why should we be shepherds? Here's the question. After you've been burned badly in shepherding relationship and feel reluctance to jump back in, how do you overcome the frustration and the depression and get back out there? That might not ultimately be a question, but an observation of the reality of shepherding and pastoring and caring. I think part of it is there's something that's going to be really helpful in making sure that you know the difference between a goal and a desire. Because a goal will move you toward idolatry, and a desire will just allow you to grieve and lament. It is a godly desire. Well, I'd like you to like me. I mean, that's an okay desire. That's not evil to have that desire. But if that becomes my goal, I'll begin manipulating you. I'll begin seeing your response as, do you see the difference? If I have a goal, I want my kids to turn out great. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a godly goal. Who doesn't want their kids to turn out well? But when that becomes, I have a desire for my kids to turn out well. But when that becomes a goal, that becomes my happiness, my life becomes dependent on their behavior. And when my happiness or my success or my anything is determined by somebody else, then that's just the genesis of idolatry. It's the genesis of making something or a result how you're measuring. And God measures by faithfulness, not by results as much. I know pastors that in very successful churches that I know are struggling with significant sin and problems. For some reason, their church is doing okay. And I know some really faithful pastors in small churches that they couldn't get a visitor if, you know, I mean, they're doing everything they're supposed to do. And I think God will measure them not by how many people showed up at church on Sunday, but by their faithfulness. I think that's how God measures our parenting. That's how God measures our pastoring. And it's how God measures your shepherding. And what that allows you to do is take a step back from that disappointment. It is disappointing when somebody betrays you. Just disappointing. Until you've sat in the hospital room all night. And see, sometimes when you hear their stories as a shepherd, they don't want to see you anymore when things start getting better. Because you know, I've just been at this church a year and a couple of months now, but I've already been to court with a family, met some people at jail, and we're a suburban church. And I have a funny feeling that some of those people, when things get better, aren't going to want to see me every Sunday morning teaching their Sunday school class. And my guess is that they'll create a reason to not show up anymore. And there'll be a part of me that struggles with idolatry that'll say, you owe me. I went there. I've been there. I showed up. I mean, my family didn't have me that night because I came to your place. I was your shepherd. But you need to understand, sometimes you as a shepherd will remind them of their hardest places. And since it's not about you, it's not about me, then there's something about shepherding with open hands, that he is ultimately the shepherd and you're his assistant, and that and it allows it to be just a little bit different. Remember that anger is never the primary emotion you have. Anger is really a secondary emotion. Usually the primary emotion is disappointment. I'm not getting what I want. And that's something you can take to the Lord. If you're going to be a good shepherd, or I guess we should call it a shepherd's assistant, if you're going to be a good shepherd's assistant, I think you need to learn the lost art of lamenting. Jesus even lamented. I mean, in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus says, "Is there a way to do this without this?" That's a lament to the Father. A lament is not whining. Whining is turning away and complaining. "I can't believe you did that. I don't understand why you're doing that." Lamenting is to bring those concerns and fears and brokenness to him. Those questions. Why do the wicked prosper? Is there some way to reach those people without going through this cup? I mean, that's a lament, because it's not walking away from God. It's walking toward him. But it's not walking toward him pretending. It's walking toward him with an honest, soulish truth of the pain that's in you. And so it's not going to be canonized, don't worry. We've already got, but I'd learn to write your own psalms. Learn to lament the shepherding psalms of the, because you will taste betrayal and you will taste disappointment and you're going to taste loneliness sometimes, because you'll know stuff that other people don't know and you can't say anything about it. And so be aware of that. Then you say, "Well, gee, that's the worst answer to that question I've ever heard. I mean, we're kind of gearing up to shepherd," and you basically said, "Well, it's going to be a real mess." Remember in Proverbs where it says, "Where the barns are clean, there are no oxen. But with oxen, there is a great harvest." And that's such a beautiful picture. The book of Proverbs a 6-year-old can understand that, and a theologian could stay up all night thinking about that. You know, 6-year-old understands the barn's clean. Not much is going on here. There's a bunch of oxen in the barn. Must be a lot of work. You can have a clean ministry. You can be the best shepherd in town. Just don't get involved in anybody's lives. Don't really get to know their stories. Just talk to them about spiritual things. And what you'll find is at the end of the day, you'll be talked to the way that Ezekiel 34 talks about the shepherds, that you didn't really deal with them. But it'll be a clean barn. Or the odd, almost scandalous invitation of God to get you the dirt of the kingdom of God under your fingernails, and to roll up your sleeves and to be about the dirty work of redemption and hope. And you can be about that kind of work. And there'll be oxen in your barn, and oxen produce manure. But with that manure, there's a great harvest. And so I would love to tell you, I'd love to tell the person this, "Hey, it only happens once or twice in your whole life as a shepherd, so come back in, because you've had it happen once, it probably won't happen again for a while." But I can't tell them that. Tell them what I can say is, Jesus understands betrayal. His story is peppered with betrayal. It begins with betrayal in the garden, and then that's replayed again in the garden when Judas betrays him. and he understands what it feels like for the people that you've ministered to turn their back on you and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you lament to that kind of God, when you say, I feel so angry, I'm betrayed, they didn't appreciate all I've done for them. And you don't hear a mocking from heaven, but you hear an understanding from heaven. And you realize that you're writing your lament. You're talking to a God who understands what it feels like to have the ones he loves turn their back on him. So, just a great question. I wrote that. I really want to encourage you. What do you do when it's clear a person doesn't even know that there are back and deep down reasons that are influencing one's present life? You know, there are a lot of people who I mean, there's be gracious to them. Because chances are, if they're not willing to face the things that have shaped them, the things that shaped them are pretty hard. Most of the people I know that want to live 1 inch deep and 10 miles wide, it's because they're incredibly afraid of what's underneath the 1 inch. So you can have a little bit of grace for them. It's probably not because they want to be shallow. It's probably because they just don't want to be hurt. And what I do with most people is I just kind of shoot a shot over the bow every once in a while. My goal isn't to take somebody and throw them into the deep end that's never gone swimming. My goal is try to get them to go about 2 inches deeper than they were when they first started. Because we're all kind of... When I did the parenting conference here a few years ago, not that I would expect you to remember anything, this group, the only thing you'll remember from this were my pants and the Dollywoods comment. But I talked about Skylar taught me that we're all spiritually autistic, and I told a story of me helping him one day with something, and at the end of the day, he clenched his fist at me and said, "Don't you ever do that to me again." And I thought, I was just trying to help him. And there I was giving my life to him, helping him, and he was angry at me because I wasn't, because he felt inconvenienced or hurt. And that's when I thought, that's just the way I am with God. I'm spiritually autistic. And so that perspective has helped me deal with people who, because I'm not that much far ahead of them. I'm spiritually autistic too. We're all riding the short bus to glory. And I mean, that's the only way you get there. And the difference between my mind and God's mind, you couldn't measure it. The difference between Skylar's mind and my mind is this much. And so when I meet with somebody who's not willing to look at things, I'm going to try to push them. Boy, that sure sounds a whole lot like your father. Or, I guess you might be the one person that history doesn't seem to repeat. Maybe history for you doesn't repeat, but it sure seems to rhyme. You know, I'll make just comments like that. Or if it was true, how do you think it might have impacted? Those are open-ended, just invitational questions to try to move somebody a little bit further down the path. But have some grace. Usually when people don't want to talk about their past, it's because their past has been difficult. Maybe not always. But usually if somebody wants to minimize and say, I'm fine, everything's fine. Everything's fine, you don't need to. Chances are there's some things that they just don't want to dig back up. That would be helpful. I'll give you a chance if you want some feedback, if you want to ask a follow-up question or something, we can do that as well. I'm not just trying to go through these. Sometimes I just read in Greek and Hebrew. I really don't know either. Some of our shepherding flock are elderly. Do you have some suggestions of ways that they can serve the fellowship? I teach a class, we call them the prime timers at our church. I think first of all, that's probably the worst name in the world for them. I think every one of them thinks, what a patronizing name to call us. Why don't you just call us the old geezer group? I teach that every Thursday in our church, and you can see it on a man's face when he begins to believe that all of his good days are behind him. There's a hollowness. When I speak at church, and I don't that often, did I mention not regularly? Right? I'm sure where Frank is. He's gone, okay. What I always do is I go down to that primetime group and say, listen, I'm having trouble with this passage. I want you to help me. I want you to help me kind of think this through before I preach it. And these guys have studied the Bible their whole lives. They just come alive, and it's like, oh, you know, and they're giving me little details, and I'm writing them down, and then I'll usually say something at the end of our time, like, now, if the sermon ain't any good, it's your all's fault. And I go, all right. And then lately I've been saying, what can we become involved in? I had them cook a meal for all the youth last summer. That's such fun. And then the women have Bible studies in our church on the same time, and so this past fall, I had them cook lunch for all of them, and they just, it was something with purpose. They did an incredible study, it's a fascinating study, and I'll give you just the quickest of the details of it so I don't bore you with it. But they went to a retirement home, and they picked two different floors. And in both of the floors, they provided each person with their own flower, a plant to put in their room. And on one floor, and you can look this up, the words they used were almost the same as in the other floor, except in the one floor, they said, we're going to take care of this flower for you. This flower is a gift for you. It's here for you to enjoy. We will have somebody come in and water it for you. And, you know, basically, here's a flower, here's a plant for your room. We'll take care of it for you. On the other floor, they said almost the same thing, except they said, it's your responsibility to keep the plant alive. It was given to you. It's for your enjoyment. They said the same basic things about the purpose of the plant. I'm not making this up. Months later, they come and they do all these measures of the two floors, and they look at quality of life, level of depression, interests, the community. And it may not have just been because of the flowers. But the floor that felt sense of purpose did better than the floor that didn't. My son Skyler, since we've been moved to Knoxville, has had his first job in his whole life. He works one day a week. I hasn't been able to the last few weeks, but he works one day a week at Cracker Barrel, and he rolls silverware for about 3 hours. And I remember the night he came back from that, the very first time he did it. Now, we actually help pay the girl who works with him. She also works at Cracker Barrel, and she is with him. I mean, he doesn't just walk in. But the night he walked out of that Cracker Barrel, with his Cracker Barrel shirt on, after working for 3 hours, he walked different. I mean, it was like, and they pay him on a debit card, and it was like, we were going somewhere, he goes, I can buy that. You know, and so when you think of the people that you're shepherding that are older, understand the world has told them they don't matter anymore. And the world has kind of sold them a retirement lie that is not that biblical. And it's like, you need to save a lot, you need to save a lot so you can have a lot when you don't do anything. And then now that you've worked your tail off and didn't pay any attention to the things that mattered to you for all those years, now you have money, but you don't feel any purpose whatsoever. And we go, how's that working out? And so you need to understand that it's great to retire and it's great to have enough money to play golf every day. But if all you're doing is living for self, that is not a satisfying life. And a lot of what happens to the people that are older, that would be me, is that there's something that happens when you begin to see everything in your rearview mirror. And I have found that people as they get older, well, there was a psychologist by the name of Erickson who said, the task of people when they're older is either to have integrity or despair. They'll either be in one of those two places. They'll either kind of feel a sense of, is this all there was? Or there'll be a part of them that can hear the laughter on the other side. One of the guys that's about 82 that's in this group with me, he and I pray together, and he's kind of helps run it. He was telling me the other day how bad he feels. He's not feeling very good. And we all prayed together before the meeting, you know, and it was just him and I. And I said, Bob, one of these days, one of us won't be here. Odds are it'll probably be you, not me, but one of these days, one of us ain't going to be here. And I hope that I can hear, I long to live in such a way that when I hear the laughter from the other side, I know that it's you. Because that's someone who's older who feels purpose, who kind of looks at their life and says, it's hard to argue with a life lived well. I mean, I was never a big Bill Clinton fan, but I remember when they had the day of prayer for Bill, when Bill Clinton was president, and they had Mother Teresa come. And y'all have all heard this story. This is a preacher story, but this is one of the preacher stories that's actually true. But Bill Clinton, before Bill Clinton got up, Mother Teresa got up, and she just chastised America for abortion, saying, "How can the richest country in the world abort their babies because it's inconvenient?" And I mean, she just chastised America. And was pretty brutal. And there was kind of this buzz because the next person standing up was Bill Clinton. And it was like, how does he follow that with his stance on that? And he thought pretty, he stands up and he says, it's hard to argue with a life lived well. See, and that's what happens to elderly people, I am one, as I begin to wonder, has it been a life lived well? Has it been, and so you want to, if you're shepherding them, don't treat them like they, most of them have been studying the Bible longer than you have. Ask them to help. Pray with them, ask them to pray with you. Ask them for advice. Listen to their stories. You know, one of the sad things about getting older, I got a lot of stories. I'm just not sure anybody wants to hear them anymore. I think a good shepherd would stop and say, tell me some of those stories. So how did you meet your wife 40 years ago? My goodness. So what's the biggest change you've ever seen? Wow. So you are around, I mean, just a good shepherd, when you're dealing with the elderly, understand they're full of story and ideas, and they don't think anybody's interested in hearing them anymore. And you as a shepherd, you get the privilege to listen to some of those stories. So, anyway. So that's the elderly one. I get two more questions, and then we'll... regarding the topic of nurture and how it fits into our talk on shepherding, please give us some illustrations as to what that looks like specifically. I was going to say something silly, like, you expect me to be specific? What's involved in nurture? Nurture is family of origin. It's important events that have happened in somebody's life. It's the things that shaped a person. Those are nurture. It's how a person what their relational style is, how they relate to others. That's that nurture piece. And it's really helpful in shepherding to kind of try to walk into some of that. Because those are the things that they kind of sometimes determine what they do. Even little things. My wife, she hates to be late. And I hate to be early. To me, it doesn't seem like a very efficient way to live. If you're supposed to be there at 3, why show up at 2:45 and just sit there for 15 minutes? I could have been reading something, studying something. Why would I waste that 15 minutes? I mean, my goodness, movies have 25, 30 minutes of previews. Our church does announcements for the first 5 minutes. I mean, my goodness. I can do without that. And then I married Mona. She hates to be late. And so I tried to convince her that it wasn't very efficient. It wasn't being a good steward of time. I just don't think you'd be a good steward of your time, Mona. I think you're... And then one day she told me a story. My wife grew up in Rockwood, Tennessee, and she had her family had two daughters in it, Mona and Luanna. Now, her dad and mom, they were very poor. She had a bunch of brothers. Now, they didn't require the whole family to go to church, but Frank and Mackie, those would be the parents, they thought it was important that the daughters go to church. And so every Sunday morning, in clothes not as nice as maybe the people next door, in a ratty car that Frank kept running, he would drive them about 15 minutes late to First Baptist Church, Rockwood, Tennessee. And every Sunday morning, my wife and Luanna got out of that car. The deacon, brother somebody, would say, "Well, Luanna and Mona, welcome." Frank would drive off. And then Mona and Luanna would be walked. Now, you know anything about a Baptist church in Rockwood, Tennessee. You know what seats fill up first and what seats fill up last. The seats, the people who get there early, the ones that are not good stewards of their time, they sit in the back. If you get there late, you sit in the front. So every Sunday morning, Mona and Luanna get walked up to the front row. I don't know when it was, maybe when she was six, maybe when she was eight. But someday while she was walking up there, she said, when it's up to me, I will never, ever be late again. Now that's an important story for me to know. So I'm going to love her. If I'm going to love her, I need to be aware that being late's not just a matter of preference. It touches something deep inside her. Do you know the stories? That's why you need to know the stories. Those are the nurturing stories. Those are the things that happen. Now, was that a tragic event? No. Does she need to go to therapy for the rest of her life because she would know? But it's a great story to know because it shapes her. You know, and so that's the nurturing piece. We use the example of food all the time because you seem to be obsessed as a group about food. And so it's helpful to know. What is the nurture piece of food? How did your family, you know, do they always celebrate, you know, if you're kind of from a southern home and every time you walk in, there's food. Every time there's something bad happens, there's food. Every time there's something good happens, there's food. If you come from a family that couldn't get together, that didn't have food with it, that taught you something about what it means to celebrate, what it means to grieve, what it means to just live life. And it was very much tied to food. And so food isn't what it's supposed to be biblically. Food is not just supposed to be something that, biblically, food is supposed to provide fuel. It's supposed to be celebratory. It's supposed to be a place of fellowship. It's supposed to say something about the creativity of God, that we could taste all the different things we can taste. Those are the biblical reasons for food. Food's not supposed to be your friend. It's not supposed to be your enemy. But if you grew up in a family where it was, that says something, and it's helpful to know that. And so that's kind of what nurture is. Nurture is that piece of the shepherding, the piece of the discipling that kind of looks at how someone was shaped and formed. Because maybe God wants to write a different ending to their story. And maybe he doesn't want those facts to be the facts that carry on. And so it's helpful for you to know that as a shepherd. Does that make sense? So that's what kind of the nurturing is. So there's the biology of food, which would be how your metabolism and how your body processes food and what your genes say your size is going to be. That's kind of the body part. But then there's the nurture side of what food means to you and how you use food to, you know, a lot of times when after I've had a hard day, I feel entitled to food. I was a little tired last night and the entire time was over and it was really enjoyable. I really enjoyed being with you, but there was a moment where I thought, where's the food? It's nine. I deserve. I mean, that's not how many of you didn't think that way, but that comes with kind of my nurture part of me. And then there's the choice part about food, which is just no matter what your nurture is. And here's the deal. I'm still responsible for how I live my life, no matter what my nurture nature says. I still have responsibility, but it just won't be quite as easy for some as the other. And so you can have some grace. And so that's kind of what we mean by nurture. Does that make sense? All right, let's see. This is my last question. Why are you so good looking? Well, it's nature nurture choice. That really wasn't the question. I know that that's a shocker to you. All right. Sometimes I think I'm funny when I'm really not, but I appreciate the fact that you all now are pitying me and just kind of going, ha, ha, ha. Okay. What are the things we do? What are the things we do in the nature part of it? I don't think that's the same thing as the illustrations about nurture. I think this one's talking about nature. For the most part, the nature part of it's above my pay grade. However, you need to be aware that you're probably, as the shepherd, going to be the only person who's thinking about all three areas. Usually medical doctors, are thinking in the nature category. If they're going to a counselor or a psychologist, they're going to probably be thinking in the nurture category. And if they're going to, and if they're listening to their mother-in-law, they're going to be dealing with the choice issues. And you as a shepherd is going to be one of the few people that's going to be saying, this might be a little more complex than this, and God wants to intervene. And so, you know how powerful it would be from you to say, hey, you know, we've been talking, and I think it might be a good idea for you to go see a doctor about that. We'll keep working on our part. Or you might be able to, you know, we'll talk about in a second how to some ways to think about that. But you don't realize how much power you can have as someone who's wise enough to realize that it's all three of those things, because they're not going to get that. Everybody specializes. So mother-in-laws specialize in choice. Psychologists and counselors, well, some counselors just focus on choice. But a lot of counselors, they'll focus only on the nurture. And doctors will tend to focus on the nature piece. And so it's really helpful as you, as a shepherd, to kind of have a broader sense of how fearfully and wonderfully somebody's made. And the fact that you know that the body is made by God to kind of, for an arc away from depression, is kind of a great thing to know. Now that you kind of know, though, in a very simplistic way, how that medicine might actually work, chances are you know more than what they know that they're taking it, because they probably didn't get an explanation. And so it's a really a great thing to be kind of having all of that together. Does that make sense? All right. We finish at what time? 5:15. That gives us 20 minutes. So we're going to vote. How many of you would like to kind of go over some of those basic questions that would help you to know how much biology, how much nurture, how, you know, kind of that sort of stuff? You like that? I guess I should give you the other choices. we'll eventually talk about all this stuff, or talk about anxiety. You are an anxious bunch of people. All right, you bunch of nervous Nellies. Now, let's remember that, again, when I think about anxiety, we are a very anxious society. We're a very anxious society. Anxiety has gone up quite a bit. Since 9/11, anxiety has gone up a bit. Why is that? Fear. We had this illusion that we were in control, and maybe we're not as much in control. Well, I'm going to do the same thing with depression that I did with anxiety. I'm going to do the same thing with anxiety that I did with depression. I'm going to oversimplify the nurture piece of it, so that you've got kind of an avenue of questions to kind of ask, just a lane to drive the car in, knowing that it's a little more complex than this, and knowing that there is a nature piece to anxiety. There are some people's brains that just spin. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. God set you up to be a slightly more anxious than not. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason, because that bends toward glory. If you're in the woods and you see a brown mound in the grass, it could be a lion or a rock. Well, which is it to your benefit to believe that it is? It is your benefit to think that might be a lion. And so I'm going to be a little more careful, because if it's a rock, but you thought it was a lion, you just walked a little bit further than you needed to. But if it was a lion and you thought it was a rock, you're lunch. And so when God made us, we are made to have, our brains are made to notice new and novel stimuli. We are bent in such a way, physiologically, to be slightly more anxious than not. Does that make sense? So the system that God built in you is a system that helps protect you, but it can go awry. And all of a sudden, you see lions everywhere. And you're anxious all the time. Or do you know what I mean? So first one, I just say the nature piece of anxiety is real as well. Everybody's brain's different. Some people have brains that spin faster than others. Some people, part of autism is to have a little bit of an anxious brain. And Skyler will sometimes get something stuck in his head and he can't. And you can't discipline it out of him. It's an obsessive piece that's it gets stuck in his brain and he just starts spinning. The other day we're in the grocery store and he says, "Dad, I don't think we locked the car." And I said, "It's okay, son. There's nothing in there for anybody to steal." And he goes, "No, I don't think we locked the car." And I said, "It's no big deal, son. We're okay." And it's like, Dad, I think we've got to go out and check and see if we lock. It just got stuck in him, and it wasn't. I didn't need to discipline and say, "You won't go." I mean, it was physiological. It was his brain. And some people's brains are more anxious than others. Just need to be aware of that. And so that's the nature piece. And as with most psychological diagnoses, the irritability index is usually around the same as depression, around 30 to 40%. And they do that from twin studies where they look and see how much variance there is between the diagnoses of people who were raised in different families who had the same genetics. And so when they do that, they come up with a number that they can say, well, from the same word as heredity comes from, the irritability ratio or factor. For most psychological type disorders, it's about 30 to 40%, depending on the study. Some things it's less, but with anxiety, you're thinking that. So there's a biological piece to anxiety. There are people that are just more anxious than others. Some people's brains spin more than others. Some people are more hypervigilant than others. Now, I'm going to oversimplify the nurture piece. Somebody comes to you and they're anxious. They're having trouble. They're feeling a lot of anxiety. Here's my oversimplified way to think of it, just a lane to drive on when you're shepherding somebody who's anxious. The things that matter most to us in our lives, we don't control. And for the most part, in the nurture lane, anxiety is about control. There is a part of a brain that's obsessive, can make people obsessive compulsive, but some people are a little more obsessive compulsive when things aren't working well in their lives. And that's because what happens in the nurture side of obsessive compulsive behavior. I may not be able to control whether people love me or not, but I can make sure my closet's clean. I can make sure all my shirts are in the right order. There's a way in which there's a control piece to that. And so when I think of somebody who's struggling with anxiety, and then there's choice, right? You know, are you praying? Are you praying, be anxious for nothing? Am I taking those scriptures, those ideas, those worries to the Lord? That's the choice piece. Am I not drinking buckets of Mountain Dew or just big crafts of coffee. It's amazing to me how much coffee we drink in our culture, and then people say, "I'm really anxious." And I go, Well, you know, maybe, I'm just saying, you've had enough caffeine to add, you know, to start a fire. But, you know, well, it doesn't affect me. I just can't sleep anymore. Maybe it could affect you. That's a choice piece. Do you meditate? How are you dealing with stress? Those are choice pieces. By the way, stress moves you, stress intensifies anything, any of your struggles you have, addictions, anxiety, depression, stress increases that. At some level, stress is related to your perceived importance of the event and your perceived competence. And so if I think I can't do something, but it's really important, I'll be anxious. I was not overly anxious about coming here until I kind of realized who some of my heroes here. And then I got a little nervous. Why? Because my perceived competency is the same, but the perceived importance, I need their approval. So it increased my anxiety, right? That's stress management. I had a physician friend once tell me, we were talking about something about blood pressure or something, I don't know. And he said, how's your stress? And I said, I think I handle stress pretty well. And I'll never forget it. He looks at me and goes, no, nobody handles stress well. Stress handles them. And so what you do with stress, what do you do with the stress of your life, that's the choice pieces. Are you praying? Are you meditating? Are you saving time to for healthy things? Do you have relationships in your life? I mean, those are the choice pieces, and those are really important. And you can help somebody when you're shepherding somebody and they have a lot of anxiety to kind of ask them about their relationships and how things are going. But the nurture piece, that extra piece that I want you to include now in your shepherding tool belt for anxiety usually has to do with control. And so you start thinking about where in their life have they been out of control historically. That kind of ends one. That kind of sets the how high the water is in the glass, and what presently is going on in their lives that's increasing their anxiety. I had a girl once come to me talking to me about her panic attacks, and I said, "Well, tell me what's been going on in your life." And she started describing all these things that were just out of control in her life. And I said, well, I'm really disappointed in you. And she said, why? And I said, I think, she had 4 panic attacks the week before. And I said, I think you should have 5. And she looked at me really funny. And I said, because she was afraid she was crazy. She's not crazy. She was feeling like everything was out of control in her life. And she had a pretty anxious brain. And she wasn't making the choices that lower stress. And so she was just in a perfect storm and I said, and this is not great physiology or anything, this is kind of psychologically talking about it, but I said, have you ever carried a pack a long way? A real heavy pack, maybe a book bag, and the strap started to get to you and the muscle, and you couldn't move the strap, and it started to kind of spasm? It's your body saying that there's too much weight on that body. That's your body's response to that pressure. And I said, I think your panic attacks, I mean, part of it's your brain and part of it's your choices, but I think part of it is that it's your body telling you that there's a weight that's starting to wear you down. And she goes, so I'm not crazy. Well, at least not about this. You would not believe how calming that was for her. It was like, I thought I was crazy. She comes back in the next week, and this is back when I had my private practice in Orlando, and she came back in the next week, and I said, so did you have all your panic attacks that you were supposed to have? And she goes, no, I didn't. As a matter of fact, now I'm not suggesting that. I'd encourage her to go see a doctor, and she was seeing a doctor, and we encouraged her to do some other things. But all of a sudden, what I gave her was a sense of control. And control and anxiety are related to one another. And so historically, if somebody grew up in a family that where there was abuse or they've been, I mean, what we're finding out about the effects of trauma on children is just absolutely fascinating. When they're doing work with helping opiate addicts, they have found there's a correlation between success in getting over their addiction and the number of early traumatic events in their lives. The more of those events, the more difficult it is, it seems, to move out of the addiction, even though those were events that happened so long ago. So that's historical places where the person fell out of control. That's kind of where they kind of learned some of their anxiety. And then they're presently, how are they doing? Where are they feeling out of control? And so it's just really helpful. So back to the question, why are we a more anxious society today? Because there was a time where we felt like we had a lot more control over everything. There was a time we thought well, the economy, I got control over that. Why do missionaries struggle with anxiety so much? Well, because they don't know if the guy's going to really pay the money that, you know, will the church really completely support me next month? There's that's I don't control that. We don't control the things that matter most to us. However, and I don't want to cheapen it by giving a simple, easy answer, but we do know the one who does have control. And there is, it's interesting, it seems to me that some of the passages that deal with anxiety in Scripture will make a reference to relationship with God, like in Romans 8 where it says, you've not been given a spirit that makes you a slave to fear again, you've been given the spirit of sonship or of adoption that allows you to call God Abba Father. That was the best I could remember. It's basically that. You never trust somebody who goes, the Bible basically said that. but what does it do? It says, hey, you're not a slave to fear. Oh, great. Then what am I? You're a child of God. And so there really is a way in which there's a perspective shift that's supposed to make a difference. Supposed to help us make a difference. That tends to fall into the choice piece. Is somebody bathing themselves in that sort of the sort of truth of Scripture and their relationship with Christ? And then I can look at the nurture piece, and that lane is going to be, I'm going to ask questions about control in their lives, where presently and in the past. And then for some people, I'm going to be really aware they may need to be talking to a medical doctor that might help them deal with that brain that spins faster than mine. Does that make sense? We've just talked about two of the most common things you're going to run into shepherding. In America, you'll deal with depression and anxiety, boom, all the time. And so they're just helpful to kind of get a sense of what do I do when somebody's struggling with anxiety. All right, real quick, three questions to help me kind of figure out what is going on. Now, these are not diagnostic questions. I'm not making you, you're not going to be at the end of this junior licensed therapist. You're shepherds. So this is just... You're out looking for the lost sheep, and you come across a sheep that looks anxious. And you go, I'm probably going to need to get this to an expert, but for now, what do I do? I mean, does this sheep need to be picked up? Does this sheep need to be chastised? What do I do? So this is not professional diagnostic questions. If you went to a medical doctor, if you went to a psychiatrist and said, hey, I've got the three questions to help me know what to do diagnostically, and they said, well, where do you learn that? I'll tell them I didn't say it, because it so So the first question is this. Somebody's talking to you and they're really talking about, and you go, gosh, this depression stuff, I wonder, one of the things I want to know is, anybody else in your family ever been depressed? I mean, father, mother, brother, sister, grandfather, uncle, aunt, anybody in your family been depressed before? Why is that important? Well, we know that things run in families. Now, it's so amazing. The Bible is a fascinating book. And so before we had science that people said, you know, before we had people that were kind of talking about how diagnosed that you know, if your dad was depressed, there's a chance that you'll be depressed. But before we kind of knew all that sort of stuff, God wanted to tell us things that would communicate to a tribesman as well as someone 100 years from now if he doesn't return. And so how does the Bible talk about the fact that things run in families? Well, the sins of the father go from generation to generation. That speaks of and I've heard some crazy teaching on that. You know, generational this and generational that. It's just a real, it's how do you teach that when people didn't know anything about genetics? How does God tip his hat to just helping us understand that things run in families? Well, that's what he did. Now we know it in a little more sophisticated way than they would have back then. But so it's grateful to know. And so I'm sitting there talking to somebody. It's a sheep I just came up on. I'm in charge of, I'm their assistant shepherd, and so I'm caring about them. And they seem to always be depressed. And I'm going, gosh, do I need to tell them to go see a doctor? I mean, well, I don't know what to do. Should I just focus on grandmother's rules? If they tell me, yeah, well, my dad was depressed. My father's name is Eeyore. I mean, at that point, I go, oh, my goodness. And that makes me lean a little more toward nature, because that means there's something going on there. Now, that's my first question. My second question, and by the way, if you want kind of some really instructional videos on how to be a good shepherd, go back to the old TV shows and watch Columbo. I used to have counseling students watch Columbo because he would just kind of, help me understand why there's a bloody knife here on the, and he was just kind of this curious, humble guy that, you know, would ask good questions. So ask a question like, well, how early do you remember being depressed in your life? And so if you're talking to a 40-year-old and they say, man, I feel like I've been depressed since I was like 5 years old. I mean, my parents used to call me, you know, Don the Downer. I used to sing the blues. Those are my favorite. I mean, if somebody has a long history and early, what they might say and what a clinician might say, early onset of the diagnosis or early onset of the symptomology, when I see that, that makes me say, I'm going to lean a little bit more to more nature. But if they say, I don't know, I've just been depressed the last 6 months. And I just can't get out of it. Now, is there still nature involved in that? Well, sure, maybe. But I'm going to lean a little bit more toward the nurture. Now, the good thing is I don't have to make the decision. I'm just trying to find out what lane to drive in sometimes. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm a shepherd, and you're a shepherd, and I wanted to try to find out what lane. Third question. And really, it's more as an observation. Is there a triggering event? If there's no triggering event, they've been depressed for 30 years. Their mother and father were always depressed. I'm going to say, listen, we can talk about this, all this stuff, and I can tell you to go and try harder, and I can tell you to read your Bible, and we'll work on that, but you need to see a doctor. Because it's tripped all three of those questions for me. Now, please, these are not medical questions. These are not even psychological diagnostic questions. You can't make a diagnosis of depression based on this. This isn't the DSM. I mean, I'm not giving you the criteria. I'm just giving you practical ways to think about this when somebody comes before you. Does that make sense? I'm just trying to give you some tools. Depression, anxiety. By the way, I mentioned in depression, I didn't mention, why are women more likely to be diagnosed than men, depression? Huh? Well, you know, there's probably lots of reasons. But one of the reasons is that estrogen does a little bit of a dance with serotonin. And so, remember what serotonin was? Serotonin is that neurotransmitter God put in us to make our bodies lean toward the way that depression would not kill us. Just like he has our anxiety lean in the direction that we won't get killed when we see the rock. I mean, it's an amazing system that we've been born with. But it does a little bit of a dance with estrogen. And so because of that, women will be more likely to be diagnosed with depression than men and with mood disorders in general. And what else do we know? I mean, just think about it. Aren't there sometimes during a woman's cycle that she might be more anxious or more depressed? Well, yes. Well, that's not just in her mind. There is a way in which serotonin does a little bit more of a dance with estrogen than it does, and therefore for a woman. So when a woman has a baby, postpartum depression, that's one of the reasons for it, because after menopause, there's often depression. There's a reason for that. And then that's the biological part. That's the part I don't know much about. But you ought to be aware of that. That's how things work. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And just because we can't fix that doesn't mean we ought to ignore that might be part of the journey that somebody's on that we're engaged with. Does that make sense? All right, our time is 5:20. We're 5 minutes over. So I'm going to say a prayer, and then we're all going to go eat. Father, I've enjoyed watching the faces of your junior shepherds here today. Oh, Father, great questions. They're natural curiosity. Father, even after a long day, the way they've listened so well. Father, there's people in this room that struggle with anxiety and depression as well. I know in this room there are people that are wrestle with a brain that spins or a fear that life's out of control. And so I pray that you would let this material be helpful to them. I pray that it would somehow shepherd your junior shepherds. Father, for the people that are too comfortable, would you disrupt them? For the people disrupted, would you comfort? And would you equip us all? We pray in the powerful name of Jesus. Amen.